This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
When I was going over segments to replay on the program at the end of the year, I remembered this one from April, and I also remembered what fun I had producing it. Hope you have fun listening again. Back in the early 1970s, a new network called National Public Radio hired a young producer who had two special interests, baseball and science. And since there was very little chance of NPR running Mets games, he got on the air with that other topic.
They knew that I knew more about science than the announcers they were using, so they said, all right, go ahead, yeah, go do some science.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, my conversation with Ira Flato, the person who founded NPR's Science Unit and the host of the weekly public radio program Science Friday. And we'll spend an academic minute learning that high school is forever. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. When you sit down in a room with Ira Flato, it doesn't take long to figure out that he loves science. Since he got his start with NPR back in the early 70s, Flato has been covering advances in science and technology both on the radio and on public television as host of the program Newton's Apple. For the past 25 years, he's been the host of the weekly radio program Science Friday. Back in April, Ira Flato visited me in the studio, and we talked about how his career started, in TV or radio.
Radio. I actually got into it by accident. When I was in college, I was studying to be an engineer, getting my engineering degree. But I was having a really awful time at it, and I thought I always wanted to be one, but discovered I was no good at it. But I wanted to stay in engineering, so I kept going at it and eventually did get my engineering degree. But in high school, I'd done a lot of theater. And I'd done some TV in high school on the technical side, working a TV camera, things like this. So when I got to school in Buffalo, they didn't have a TV station. They had a radio station. So I thought I would go in and join the technical side and, you know, turn the dials when they had dials and radio stations. And by that time, the anti-war movement, the Vietnam late 60s anti-war movement was moving east. It had come from Berkeley, went to Chicago, came to Buffalo. And there were these demonstrations. There were downtown demonstrations. In the city, they wanted to beef up the news division. So they had I just had arrived at the radio station my first day, and they said, who wants to learn how to be a reporter? We want to be – I looked around. I could do that. I'll try that. And I raised my hand. They literally threw a tape recorder at me, one of these old big heavy ones when they had reel-to-reel portables. And they said, all right, now you're a reporter. Go learn how to do this and go out and cover. Go down to this rally in Niagara Square in Buffalo and come back.
Was this summer or winter?
This was spring.
Spring, okay. So it's just a little snow.
Bad stuff doesn't start in Buffalo or any place. That's why you have all these demonstrations and things in the spring. They wait for things to thaw.
Okay, you know? That's smart. Yeah. Smart move there.
Well, so I stayed there for 3 years, and I was in the right place at the right time because my boss then left Washington, Bill Siemering, to start NPR in 1970. And I was graduating right after that, and I said, get me out of Buffalo, Bill. No, I never said it that way before. That's a good way.
It's Buffalo Bill. Good. Yeah.
And he said, you're overqualified. I said, what do you mean? He said, I'd like to hire you. I need a staff, but I just hired somebody, a producer named Wertheimer and another one named Stamberg, and they come in as producers, and then they're on the radio. I need somebody who'll stay off the radio. I said, look, I was news director, and he was right. He finally talked him into it, and he hired me. And the first introduction to the staff was, this is Ira Flato. He worked with me in Buffalo. He will never be on the air. I wanted to crawl under the table. But 3 days later, the Washington senators, this is in 1971, were leaving Washington to go to Texas in baseball. And they needed somebody to cover that, and they knew I was a big baseball fan. They said, all right. Just this once, go ahead, you can do that. And I got on the air, and then they started covering more science, and they knew that I knew more about science than the announcers they were using. So they said, all right, go ahead, yeah, go do some science.
Quick backtrack, when you covered the senators, did you get to talk to Ted Williams?
No. Ted Williams was – they had already left. There was the Giant Food Store, which is a big supermarket chain. The president, Joe Danzanski – I remember this. I can't – it was 40 years ago. He went back to Texas to try to talk them into coming back to Washington, which we knew that wasn't going to work, but gave me an excuse to cover a baseball story.
So were you put on a science beat at NPR?
Yes. In fact, NPR over the years was a pioneer in covering a lot of science. And in the early days, I was the only science reporter there. I started the science unit that's still in existence at NPR. NPR loved to cover science. So we would cover science meetings. There was a big American Association for the Advancement of Science had an annual meeting somewhere in the country. And we would go live and broadcast from the meeting during the day. And some really weird things happened. We had the first bathroom flush heard around the network, I think, because we were in a hotel room. Somebody didn't close the door. And then we were recording an event, actually it was live, of the psychology of humor. What makes something funny? And so a psychologist was telling jokes, and they were getting to be more and more off-color jokes. And I hear the beginning of a joke being said, and I'm with my engineer in the truck. We're listening, and I said to him, uh-oh, I know the punchline of that. I know that punchline, and it's not going to be good. And sure enough, bam, the F word comes out, goes through, you know, and it didn't make some people happy in Washington, but it was all in the name of science.
It's a science. Yes. That's it. Well, now you're in the early to mid-70s here covering science. What types of things were you covering?
Oh, the environmental movement. The Environmental Protection Agency was just started by Richard Nixon then. So you would cover stories about rivers catching fire. There were rivers, catching fire. The pollution was terrific. You could see the air, you know, which was not a good thing. So the environmental movement was starting there. We had the end of the Apollo missions, space to the moon. That was petering out. We had the supersonic transport. Remember the SST,
sure.
The Concorde? I covered the first landing of that in Washington at Dulles Airport. And I remember so as not to snub anybody, there was a French and a British one, and they both landed virtually at the same time, and their noses came together in this giant ceremony of – they never were able to break the sound barrier across the U.S. That was the law, because people were afraid of sonic booms rattling windows.
It's only doing over the ocean.
Yeah. So they were sort of wasted. The whole thing was sort of wasted by the time they got to the U.S. Then I covered the first shuttle launches back in the early 80s. And I had as my color commentator, I had Chuck Yeager, General Chuck Yeager of the Right Stuff fame. And he owned basically the Air Force base, didn't really own it, out there in the desert in California. And after the launch, we went out to the Air Force base and he said, let me show you stuff around. And we jump into his red pickup truck and he's taking me in the flight line, in this super secret flight line of all these unknown jets and things that I said, General, what's that? He says, oh, we call that a cruise missile. What's that? That's a bomber. That's the B-1. Oh, I can't tell you much about that, that sort of thing. They didn't even have to flash ID to get in the gate. They know who he was. But he was a lot of fun, and he was a great source of information for the shuttle launches.
Early on from there, you moved – you did a little TV work for PBS. Little thing called Newton's Apple.
Newton's Apple, my mustache and my sweater vest. Yeah, I did that for 6-7 years. That was a lot of fun. It was a lot of work. It was a half-hour show on PBS, but it took days to tape, mostly because the segments were 6-7 minutes and we had no script. So it was mostly a prop. Tell me what you have here, Mr. Scientist. And he would go on, but he was not an actor or professional. He was a scientist, and he would ramble on for 20 minutes. Well, we only had 7-minute hole to put that in, so we'd have to do it over and over and over again until we got it down to that length of time. And every time I would look at it, I have to make believe I hadn't seen it before. Oh, what do we have here? You know, I've seen this for 3 hours now. You know, and so it was a lot of fun, but it took a lot of work.
And that was a fairly popular program.
Very
7 years.
Yeah, popular program. And then I said, all right, I need a rest from that for a while. And I decided, what could I do that I could still do science things and take a break? And I decided to write a book. So I wrote my first book. I had an idyllic life for about a year and a half. I could write for all morning a book called Rainbows, Curveballs, and Other Wonders of the Natural World Explained, still available for 30 cents on Amazon. And then I could play golf in the afternoon. I said, wow, this is good. I could get paid to write and I could play in a cheap golf course near where I live. This is like great. And then I got bored with that after the book was done. I wasn't a very good golfer and worse now. So I decided to look and go back into radio and see what else was happening. And I said, look, talk radio. There's this thing called talk radio happening. Maybe NPR might like a talk show. So I went back to NPR. I was looking around for some funding for a weekly science talk show. And I went back to NPR and they were very happy to talk about it. But they said, you know, two things that are wrong here. One is talk radio is not very popular on NPR or public radio yet. And two, if you do one day of the week, what are we going to do the other 4 days? How do we get the, you know? I said, okay, let me tackle problem number two first. I'll go talk to other people. I went to Susan Stamberg, went to Diane Rehm, people like that. I'll do one day, you do the other days? Okay, we'll think about it. But right as I was thinking about this, a fortunate thing happened. Saddam Hussein bailed me out.
You would be the only person who have ever said
that's
that.
Right. The first Gulf War happened and NPR created a talk show every day to talk about what happened during the war. What's the news of the war? And that war only lasted a few weeks, but it whetted the appetite of public radio stations to have a daily talk show. And so they said, give us one. And then I raised my hand again and I said, remember my science idea? And Bill Buesenberg, who was the head of the news department there, said, okay, you get Friday. We'll do the other 4 days of the week. And that's how Talk of the Nation Science Friday got on the air. And we've been on – we're in our 25th year now. Science Friday is celebrating its silver anniversary as we speak.
Still to come, our conversation with Ira Flatow continues with a look at the scientific advances he's reported on over the past 25 years. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and our guest today is Ira Flatow, a longtime public radio science reporter and the host of the weekly program Science Friday. We're talking about his 25 years hosting Science Friday, and I asked him about the different scientific advances he's seen over those years.
Well, you know, when I first started in this business, there was no there was no genetic engineering. It hadn't been invented yet. I mean, now all of that is new. And in the last 25 years, we have all the fruits of genetic engineering. We have cloning and we have my favorite new thing now we've talked about the most is the microbiome in your body. There are trillions of bacteria that live in your intestines, in your gut. So the DNA in your body, if you count up all the DNA in your body, there's as much or more foreign DNA in your body that doesn't belong to you as there is your own stuff. But it controls what – it eats what it wants to eat and it gets hungry. And depending on what that population is made out of, it may want to eat things that are bad for you. So you want to eat things that are bad for you. It may make you depressed and so you get depressed because it interacts with your brain. It may want to eat stuff that will make you fat so you start getting fat. So we are just learning just the tip of the iceberg of how important that microbiome is in your body.
Going to other things, I mean you must have seen – the rise of the internet.
Yes. We saw that. We did a show in 1993, 2 years after we went on the air, called What is This Thing Called the Internet? And it was crazy because they tried to describe what something called, you know, there's this new thing called the World Wide Web. What's that like? You click on a mouse, you use a mouse. It's indescribable. And then people, we asked our listeners, what would you do with this thing if you could do with it? And I remember a listener calling in and saying, wouldn't it be great – I know this can't happen, but wouldn't it be great if you could like download a CD on the internet and get music on the internet? Wow, that would be something. And then a guy, a scientist, calls in. He says, we could study this and this and this and then and global warming and this. And as I'm listening to the rebroadcast, this global warming, we were talking about that in 1993. And then as I went through the archives again, I see 1994. Someone else is talking about what they called the greenhouse effect back in those days. And they labeled it global warming then. I'm saying – we think that we just discovered global warming, but these scientists have been talking about it for at least 25 or 30 years.
Well, looking at where you were when you started and, you know, can you imagine what you might be talking about 10 years
from
now?
I don't. I think we'll be talking about cures for things. I mean, more cures for things that we have been looking at over the years. Once we get – I was just reading today about these all basic research things. I was reading today about stem cells, and that's something we never talked about before on Science Friday years ago. Stem cells, these cells that are in your body that can turn into any cell that you want. I was reading today about research that showed that it's possible to regrow the cartilage in your knee with stem cells and your hips with stem cells. Whoa. They've done this successfully in pigs, which are very close to us. You know all those knee and hip replacements that we have to take out? Imagine – if we could just put the cartilage back in, the natural cartilage back in to grow instead of getting a transplant or getting a hip joint, whoa, I can't wait for that because I'm getting close to where I need one of those.
A million surgeons just started weeping.
So, you know, there's that and who knows, and going to other planets, Mars. I mean, I think we're going to go to Mars someday. We're going to discover all these other new planetary objects that circulate. We found Planet 9 maybe, you know, it's Planet X that they call it. Although there are planetologists who still believe that Pluto is a planet. And so who knows what other kinds of stuff. We might find life in the moons of Jupiter or in that neighborhood where there are seas. The moons of these planets have actually underwater seas. So –
are there things you thought you would have seen by now that haven't happened yet?
Yeah, I thought the one thing I thought I would have seen because we've been following this on Science Friday for a while. I thought by now we might have a cure for diabetes because I know people are working on stem cells over the years on this. We've been following some scientists. We know how to sort of make your pancreas, where insulin is made, grow back. But if it keeps if you grow it back and then it dies off again, that's not really a cure. We don't know really how to stop the body from attacking itself. And these are autoimmune diseases that are not just diabetes. There are other diseases. So once we learn how to stop the body attacking itself, then you know we've gone miles ahead, and we're far ahead on this on something new now. Jimmy Carter mentioned a while back that he was cured of his cancer because he had taken a new kind of treatment that makes the body tweak its own immune system. And they call this immunotherapy. Instead of chemotherapy, where you have chemicals that kill the bad cells and they kill the good cells also, that's why chemotherapy is so rough on your body, they have something called immunotherapy now, which allows your own immune system to identify cancer cells. Cancer hides very well. It hides in the body. That's why we can't kill it. But now we have found ways to unmask the cancer cells. And once they're unmasked, the body can go in, don't need chemotherapy, can go in itself and destroy the cancer cells. And I think that's going to be the future.
A lot of amazing things. You've got job security.
Job security. Well, there are more stories. There are more stories than we can ever handle.
All right. Thanks so much for
Thank
your time.
Thank you.
One more thing. Before Flato came to the studio, I spoke to him on the phone. During that conversation, we talked about when he played himself during a guest appearance on the sitcom The Big Bang Theory. So, Ira, what's Jim Parsons really like?
Very nice guy. You know, everybody thinks that he's a geeky person, but he's really an actor and a very good one. And all of them, I got to know all of them on The Big Bang Theory. And in fact, I asked the writers. The writers came over to me, and then we talked shop about science. They're always looking for tips on what's hot in science so they can get them into the program. So we were talking science, and I said, you know, these guys just look so geeky. I mean, you do such a good job at geeky stuff. And they said to me, you know who the biggest geek in the room is? You are. He said, you're a real geek. These guys just play one on television.
That's a bit of a compliment coming from them.
It was. And they recreated my radio studio. I mean, you think about it. You know, you're on radio. You think about all the stuff that goes on. And you're in the middle of a foreign land there, and they're in Warner Brothers and the big sound studio. And they're building an exact duplicate, because I sent them photos, an exact duplicate of my radio studio, down to the where do you put your thermostat. And the last thing they said was, is anything missing here? And I looked around and said, oh, yeah, you know, there's one important thing missing. There's no clock on the wall. Most important thing in a radio studio is a
Absolutely.
Clock. And they got into the, well, if we put a clock, they started arguing amongst themselves, we have to move the minutes every. Remember when we had that last show, the clock? We had to keep moving the minutes. So they put the clock in, but it never showed up in the shot. But I tell you this because here I am like an outsider, and they're very making me feel as home, feel at home as much as possible. But I wanted to feel comfortable. I went over to that little bit of the set where his radio studio was. I sat down in my chair, and I thought I was back home. You know, it was spooky.
Ira Flatow is celebrating 25 years as host of Public Radio International's Science Friday. You can hear more at sciencefriday.com. Memories may come and go, but as far as your brain is concerned, high school is forever. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
High school memories never fade. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Frank McAndrew, professor of psychology at Knox College, details why the memories made during our formative years are so strong no matter how old we are.
Many of us remember high school with an emotional mixture of nostalgia, anger, and embarrassment. The splintered social world of competing cliques grinding each other up in the gears of the social hierarchy is not easily forgotten. Memory researchers have in fact identified something called the reminiscence bump, which means that our strongest memories come from events between the ages of 10 and 30. Even the music from those years gets imprinted on our brain like nothing that comes later. What is it about this period of our lives that makes it so memorable? In a nutshell, it is the collision between evolution and that holding pen for teenagers known as high school. In our prehistoric world, your social position in the group was set during adolescence. It was just not possible to move somewhere else and start over. A person who was a loser at 18 was unlikely to rise to prominence at 40. And so, adolescent competition had lifelong consequences. Emotions signal the brain that important events are happening, and the teen years are chock full of emotional social feedback about one's skills, attractiveness, and status. Obsessing over this feedback can fuel a never-ending thirst for popularity. Strong conformity pressures during this time ensure that you do not stray too far from the peer group's values. Ostracism from the group in prehistoric times was tantamount to a death sentence. We were also programmed to remember details about the character of our peers. We absolutely needed to remember who has treated us well and who has not. And the side effect of this is a strong propensity for holding grudges. It may protect us from being taken advantage of again, but it can also make for some uncomfortable moments at high school reunions. Given all of this, it is no wonder that the English romantic poet Robert Southey once wrote that the first 20 years are the longest half of your life, no matter how long you might live.
That was Frank McAndrew of Knox College. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.